an Arecibo targeted search to a 26-meter antenna 300 hertz bandwidth system.
Sam, you took a hand with yourself. It goes easier with that thing.
Oh, is it? It was the first one that you had on.
Yeah.
Actually, but don't reverse. Up.
In this slide, I show the flux produced at the Earth in watts per meter squared to due to a transmitter with an effective isotropic radiated power ranging from a megawatt up to 10 to the 20th watts at various distances from the Earth, at 10, 100, and 1,000 light years. The dash limit shows the sensitivities produced by the targeted and the 26-meter surveys. This is the targeted survey. This line up here is the highest, is the maximum sensitivity you see with a 26-meter antenna surveying the entire sky. It can be seen that the targeted search reaches a truly impressive level, perhaps able to detect television from our nearest stars. The all-sky search has the capability of detecting Earth-like planetary radar systems, which is Arecibo radiating 10 to the 13th watts, but these would be directed at the Earth. We of course have no evidence that anyone is trying to signal the Earth from a nearby star, but any advanced civilization capable of detecting our presence via television or by other means may well set up a beacon to catch our attention. Let me turn now to the search in frequency space. In the free space microwave window, which I won't bother to discuss since Dr. Oliver has already discussed it, there have been numerous suggestions for SETI frequency searches throughout this entire range, from 1 to approximately 100 gigahertz. The most widely discussed frequency preferences involve the use of frequencies which are in the vicinity of astrophysical spectral lines. The line of neutral hydrogen at 1.4 gigahertz is the most widely discussed frequency. It's dating back to the original suggestion by Capone and Morrison in 1959. Other examples are the lines from the OH radical near 1.6 gigahertz, which often exhibits major emission and is therefore very strong. The formaldehyde line at 4.83 gigahertz is also mentioned because it exhibits a very low background temperature. That is, it's frequently seen acting like a refrigerator, cooling down the background. The 22.2 gigahertz water line, which both shows maser action and may be symbolic of water-based life, has been mentioned. Other classes of frequencies which have been mentioned include harmonics of various spectral lines, frequencies derived from fundamental constants, and frequencies based on optimum signal to noise. In summary, there are numerous frequency bands in the microwave window which are potential source of interest for SETI. Believing that it makes sense to trade off sensitivity for increased spatial and frequency coverage, my colleagues Mike Jansen, Tom Piper, and George Morris at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory have been investigating ways in which existing antennas can be used for ETI searches. We find that the primary limitation in carrying out all-sky searches is the data rate. The data rate, expressed in words per second, is simply the number of channels divided by the time spent observing each element in the sky. The next two slides show the data rates for a constant sensitivity survey and for a constant beamwidth survey. Okay, this slide shows the data rate per second versus the frequency, which is the upper limit of our survey, assuming that we start at 1.5 gigahertz and we try to carry out an all-sky survey up to this limit. We assume the starting frequency is 1 gigahertz and that the time to carry out the survey is 5 years, and we use a 10 to 6 channel spectrum analyzer. The dashed lines, the horizontal dashed line, give an estimate of what the data processing capability is for various computers. A CDC 7600 having a maximum rate of slightly better than 10 to the 6 words per second, and a XDS 920 having something like 10 to the 4th words per second. As an example, if we were going to use a 1 meter diameter telescope and operate from 1 gigahertz up to 25 gigahertz, then our maximum data rate would be 10 to the 4th words per second, and we could easily process that with a very small 920 computer. On the other hand, if we try to carry out the same survey with a 64 meter telescope, then our data rate is getting up above 10 to the 7th words per second, and we are restricted to having at least one major scientific computer online. This survey is shown for constant sensitivity. If we look at the same thing and assume that we keep our beam width constant and use something like, or what are shown here are beam widths which are a tenth of a degree all the way down to 15 degrees. The solid lines will show the survey carried out with constant beam width, show that one can carry out a survey with a 1 degree net power beam width using a rather modest computer, but once your beam width gets below a tenth of a degree, then one requires a very large computer. It is apparent from these figures that to obtain a survey covering more than a very few gigahertz on a time scale of a few years, utilizing a 26 meter antenna or larger, we require the computation power of at least one major scientific computer. By sacrificing sensitivity, however, and using a small antenna or horn, the broadest coverage may still be obtained with an inexpensive computer. With these thoughts in mind, we have worked through the details of performance and the configuration for a 26 meter antenna and a series of smaller antenna. The next slide illustrates the principal components of the system. Here we have looked at three different telescopes, a 26 meter antenna which would work at rather low frequencies, around 1 gigahertz, maybe up to 10 gigahertz, a 9 meter antenna which would work up as high as the water line, 15 degree horn. We've considered systems which receive both right-hand circular and left-hand circular polarization. We have investigated the possibility of constructing a maser amplifier which covers the entire 1.4 to 25 gigahertz band with a 300 megahertz bandwidth. Following that, we would have a receiver, a spectrum analyzer with 10 to 6 channels, the same as the AIM system, a 300 megahertz bandwidth, instantaneous bandwidth. This system would achieve 300 hertz bandwidth. We broadened out the frequencies of our individual channels so that we can cover a wide frequency. And finally, our signal extractor, which then examines the output of our spectrum analyzer and makes a decision as to whether or not we have an intelligent signal presence. This next slide gives the data rates at various stages of this receiver. We start with the output of the fast Fourier transform. The data is coming out at 10 to the 10th bits per second. We then would run that into a spectrum accumulator and reduce that to 10 to the 5th bits per second. We do a further analysis here, searching for extraterrestrial signals. Reduce that to 10 to the cube. Finally, we store data which is of interest to radio astronomy. We're considering storing the equivalent of one magnetic tape a day for radio astronomy and one magnetic tape a day for SETI purposes. This next slide shows some of the parameters which went into the went into the calculations. We considered two systems, a narrow beam search using the 26-meter antenna, the system noise temperature of 300 Kelvin, and observing time for one frequency setting for 6 months with the 26-meter and 2 weeks for the 15-degree half power beam with horn. And these give fluxes of 8 times 10 to the minus 24 times the frequency over 1.5 gigahertz and 10 to the minus 21. In watts per meter squared. Since the 15-degree horn antenna does not utilize our maximum data rate capabilities, we are thinking about reducing their beam size, perhaps down to 1 or 3 degrees half power, so that these can be matched. Thus far, all of our work has involved paper studies, but ongoing work at JPL is directly relevant to everything that I've discussed so far. Bob Klaus at JPL has built a K-band laser amplifier for NRAO, and he is presently working on an S-band parametric upconverter for use in telecommunications. This same system can be expanded to the wide frequency SETI system by the addition of about 6 more parametric upconverters. Also, JPL is just completing work on a 65,000 channel large-scale integrated circuit, FFT, spectrum analyzer, for RFI interference studies. This can serve as a prototype system for a 1 million channel system. In fact, 16 of the 65 channel systems could be used in parallel to produce our million channels. As for an antenna, JPL has an available 26-meter antenna, which is presently being converted for remote operation from the laboratory. This antenna is in the Mojave Desert in Southern California, about 80 miles from Pasadena, California. It's an altitude mount, and it is available for use approximately 60% of the time for SETI operations.
Back up one
slide. Let me back up one minute and show you the sensitivities which could be achieved over a 5-year period using both the 15-degree half-power beam-width survey and the 26-meter survey. The horizontal slanted line along the top shows the sensitivity which could be achieved with 15-degree half-power beam width. One sees that at the lowest frequency, we achieve about 10 to the minus 21 watts per meter squared, and at the highest frequency, 10 to the minus 19 watts per meter squared. At a few selected frequencies, the 26-meter antenna could achieve sensitivity levels which are ranged from 10 to the minus 23 watts per meter squared to approximately 10 to the minus 22 watts per meter squared. If the same system is used in the targeted mode, this is in the same mode that the Ames Research Center would use their system, one could survey 500 targets, 500 stars, and reach a sensitivity of about 10 to the minus 24 watts per meter squared. JPL has proposed to NASA that all of these elements be brought together next year in order to put together a SETI program. But as I left home about a week ago, it looked doubtful that this would be funded in 1979. Hopefully, we'll continue our work at a very low level in 1979 and try again for funding in 1980. Thank you. In our search strategy, we will be searching for 10 megahertz signals by looking in more than one channel. This can be programmed by our computer to look for various patterns or wideband signals. The only thing that we can't do is look for signals which are more narrow than 300 hertz.
But you won't be able to see correlation of signals that are spread out among the various channels.
Well, it depends on whether or not we square an ad at the output of our FFT or look for phase information, maintain the phase information.
Which you can't do if you accumulate per minute.
If we accumulate per minute, we cannot do that. That's correct. Mm-hmm. But we can program that. Our spectrum accumulator is programmable, and we will be investigating various ways in which that can be used. The other possibility is to program it to look for polarized signals.
Just to comment on that, I think you're quite right that their sensitivity to broadband signals obviously is less. The critical assumption is that the transmitting civilization has a certain amount of power. They can achieve the greatest range by cramming it into a narrow bandwidth.
Not true. If they're communicating with someone else, for example, you get a lot more capacity in bits per second in a wideband channel than in a narrow band.
But that's not a purposeful, then we would be intercepting something. That's yet another assumption. The assumption here is a purposeful beacon type signal. You're quite right. If we intercept a signal, then it could be anything.
Up until about two years ago, the subject of SETI used to be spelled with a C. The C stood for communication with extraterrestrial intelligence. We realized before we could communicate, we had to locate it. So we changed to S. And if you're referring to the difference we're looking for, trying to communicate is a very different problem than just detecting the signal. The problem we're addressing now is more that of detection, not the most efficient way of communicating once you have established contact. Okay, the next paper is by Frank Drake. We talk about the study programs in the Arecibo Observatory.
Bandwidth, which I'll justify later. There are perhaps 10 to 11 different frequencies. Those are the two big parameters, as you see, the ones in which there are many elements. Then there are bandwidths. There we can step in factors of 10 without losing much sensitivity. Integration times, which must be something like the reciprocal of the bandwidth or longer. And there, as you see, estimated that perhaps five different of each of those parameters will be sufficient to span a reasonable number of possibilities for extraterrestrial signals. One must observe two polarizations if one is sure not to miss the signal. And lastly, there's a very troublesome parameter, which is the duty cycle. Perhaps there are very powerful transmissions, but they are not directed at the Earth at all times. If a very large antenna like Arecibo is used, the duty cycle, that is, the percentage of the time the signal is actually impinging on Earth, may be only one part per million. Now, we must search, then, the multiplicity of combinations of all these factors. And you get that multiplicity by multiplying all these things together. And as you see at the bottom, the total number of combinations is 10 to the 26th. Now, this is the dimensions of the cosmic haystack. It's something even us in SETI hate to confront with such a large number. And it is this number which we must deal with in considering searching. So far, about a million of these possible combinations have been searched by weather. There has been a lot of SETI searching. A million possible combinations, a million elements of this six-dimensional phase space. It's a lot of searching, as you can see, only a small fraction of the total number, and therefore we should not be surprised that no signal has yet been discovered. Now, the game, of course, is to try to find ways to reduce the number of elements to be searched. The first ideas in SETI were, in fact, aimed in that direction. The suggestion of Morrison and Piconi that we search near the 21 centimeter. That minimizes the number of frequencies at which we must search. Another idea is the one you've heard already today, the idea that we should search the nearby stars. A fairly obvious idea, which again can minimize the number of directions. And then perhaps if they out there are helping us, the duty cycle will not be 10 to the minus 6, but 1. And the signal, where it exists, will be present all the time. Even with all of that help, the number of directions, or the number of elements, is reduced only, as you can see, to something like 10 to the 10th to 10 to the 17th, depending on how many of these various forms of help are really helpful. That means that even with all of this help, the SETI searches are very expensive, must be, and therefore, we must cope with that. And you've already heard the ideas to do that in terms of multi-channel spectrum analyzers and so forth. In fact, if you look at this, you will see that by far the thing we can deal with best at lowest cost at present is the frequency problem, which we do at least cost with the multi-channel spectrum analyzer. Now, with that preamble, I want to discuss some of the programs of Arecibo, all of which are aimed at doing better in coping with this multi-parameter situation. The first question we want to deal with is what is the optimum frequencies and bandwidths, etc., for communication? You have heard the arguments for use of the water hole frequencies, which are based, as Barney Oliver told you, on the minimum noise levels present in the universe. Now, I've put down here a simple schematic drawing of an interstellar communication link. There's a transmitter with power, P sub T, a bandwidth radiating through a transmitting antenna of gain G sub T, across the distance R to a receiving antenna of collecting area A sub C, and a receiver which gives a system noise, T sub S, a bandwidth, and time, observing time as you see here. The signal to noise for such a system, presented a little differently as before, is shown in the equation that you see here. All of the items in this first factor contain no natural limits. That is, what can be achieved as a function of the technology of other civilizations. There are no universal limits, and therefore we cannot use them as a guide as to what frequencies or bandwidths might be optimum for interstellar communication. As you've heard, the system noise does have a natural limitation, the one Barney Oliver described, and heretofore we have used only that as a source of wisdom, if you will, as to what are the preferred frequencies for interstellar contact. The bandwidth, however, also has a natural limitation, one we have only known of recently,
And it seems appropriate, if we're to be logically consistent, to include then not only the system noise, but the natural limitations on bandwidth arriving at the optimum frequencies for interstellar communication. Note, the smaller the bandwidth, the greater the signal to noise. In other words, we seek the minimum bandwidths permitted by interstellar communication. Permitted in interstellar communication. Now, the natural limitations on bandwidth have been recognized from pulsar observations, where we have seen variable interstellar dispersion and clear evidence through pulse mirroring of multipath propagation of the pulsar signals. The paths change with time, they are stochastic, there are many of them. In fact, one can take the pulsar observations and apply a suitable theory, speaking of the work of George Heller and myself, to deduce the spectral broadening caused by the multipath propagation and the fact that the paths are continuously changing. They do change because of motion of the interstellar medium. As they change, of course, their electrical lengths change, and this amounts to a Doppler effect and a broadening of an initially CW signal into a signal of finite bandwidth. Now, if I could have the slide projected back. Somehow missed the slide. It shows the minimum bandwidths for interstellar communication. Maybe it will come along. But they, as you might expect, become smaller at the higher frequencies where the refractive index of plasma is less, and they become broader as wider as one is looking at greater distance in the galaxy. That is where the multipath propagation assumes ever more sinuous paths. The minimum bandwidths so deduced are not simply academic, that is, they are not very small, but they're in fact of a dimension which is of practical significance. They're typically a tenth to a 100th of a hertz. This means then that we should take these theoretical values and insert them into the equation for interstellar signal noise ratio that I showed you on the new graph, along with, there it is, this is a mysterious projection, or else we have a very ingenious operator back there. I do think it's the latter. These are the theoretical, well, semi-empirical minimum bandwidths caused by the interstellar multipath propagation. And as you see, they do grow at greater distance in the galaxy and become less at higher frequencies. But as you see, at distances of, say, a kiloparsec, the frequencies of the gigahertz, we're talking about bandwidths of the order of a tenth of a hertz or so as the smallest that can be achieved.
Are those instantaneous or integrated over time?
These are instantaneous bandwidths. At any given instant, we'll see the band this way. That is, it is not a wandering of the line, of a CW line. At any given instant, what was a CW line is broadened to the width we see here. Now we take that, and we take the spectrum for system noise and insert it in that equation that I just showed you. And come out with optimum frequencies for signal to noise ratio, which are as you see here. That is, when you take into account not only the system noise, but also the minimum bandwidth, you will find that the greatest signal to noise ratio is achieved, now controlled only by natural limitations, at the frequencies you see here. A new optimum is the frequency of maximum signal to noise ratio. A new sub 1/2 is where the signal noise is dropped off by a factor of 2 due to these natural limitations. Notice these frequencies are very much higher than we've seen previously. This is because of the very small bandwidths that can be achieved at high frequencies. They're not even higher because of the quantum noise limitation on system noise. Notice they suggest that 70 gigahertz may be, after all, the best frequency for interstellar contact. And if you will, if you still want to use a magic frequency, such as H or OH, for guidance, there is the water line at 22 gigahertz, which is very near the optimum. And thus, if you want, you can combine all of your logic, that is, maximum signal and noise ratio and magic frequencies, by searching in the vicinity of the water line, which in fact has been done at the Algonquin Radio Observatory, but not elsewhere. What this says, then, is that
our logic is not unique. Indeed, if you want to put it this way, we should be searching in the water hole. The question is, which one? There are two water holes, one near the H and OH lines, another at the 22 gigahertz line. Well, now, turning now to observational programs, first, a few inspirational pictures of the telescope of Arecibo. This is, of course, the reflector, which has a collecting area of about 70,000 square meters, which will soon be operable to frequencies as high as 7 gigahertz. Unfortunately, not as high as that frequency which I just pointed out to you, which means we must concentrate our efforts at the lower water hole, if you will. And this is the platform at Arecibo, which is, as you can see, 150 meters in there. The lighthouse on the left, by the way, is a transmitter with a power of half a megawatt, which, when the beam is focused by the reflector, gives an EIRP. This thing we've been talking about 20 terawatts. There's a new unit for you today. 20 times 10 to 12 watts. Now, this has been used recently in two observational programs. Here's a typical record from one of the programs, which is searching for relatively broadband signals by our standards. These are 1 kilohertz wide signals. This particular search uses a 1008 channel autocorrelator. So what it's done here is to look at about 1 megahertz of bandwidth with 1 kilohertz resolution. And here's a third, a typical record, with the telescope pointed at a nearby solar-type star, Alpha Ophiuchi, 54 light years away, a 20-minute integration. As you can see, the minimum detectable signal is, in fact, a tenth of the strongest signal leaving Earth, which is that of the Arecibo radar system. Now, this is a third of the record. Here's the middle third. This is galactic hydrogen, which you see here, of course. Notice there's a very large peak at the velocity associated with the sun. That is, the velocity at which a signal would arrive if they were trying to signal us. And we're announcing this by offsetting their frequency so that it arrived in our system at the local standard of rest. That signal, that big peak, would require a transmitter no larger than Arecibo to transmit. So right away, of course, you have what is a typical challenging bit of data. In this case, of course, you can quickly ascertain the origin of the signal by pointing off the star and seeing if the signal goes away, which it doesn't because it is galactic hydrogen. Now, here's the rest of that record, the other 1008 channels, just to show you what it looks like. And I want to point out to you the test drive is a little bit right here, which reminds us of what some of the audience has already commented on, and that is one should be very sophisticated in analyzing these data. Here, roughly in the middle, you see what might be two signals very close together, suggesting that when we search for signals, we don't simply search for a high channel, but rather these other civilizations may be more ingenious than that. They may send two signals on closely adjacent frequencies, thereby making a non-statistically probable situation and thereby calling attention to their signals. Or in this possible case, three different frequencies, if you want to interpret that one in the center, which would make the signal even less statistically probable and again indicate extraterrestrial origin. Now, this was a look at a nearby star, and now to the two large programs that are going on. One is testing a possibility which hasn't been raised previously. And that is, if I can put it this way, that it may not be, in fact, smart to look at the nearby stars after all. But when one thinks back to the days before radio astronomy existed, would-be radio astronomers had set out to discover the radio sky by looking at the nearby stars, they wouldn't have found anything. Or even if they'd looked at the nearby galaxies, that would have failed. But we all know now that the sky is full of bright radio sources, but they aren't the bright nearest objects in the sky after all. The same, by the way, is true of the optical stars. If you go out at night and look at the sky, the brightest things you see in the sky, the things you see with your naked eye, are in almost every case not among the nearby stars, but rather very far away. What is that situation, which is contrary to our a priori guesses about things? Those situations, which happen in the natural objects, come about because of the form of the luminosity function for these objects. Now that's shown on this slide. Here's the luminosity function for normal stars, optical stars, and cosmic radio sources. You have your change in the logarithm of luminosity on the abscissa, change in the logarithm of the space density of objects of that luminosity. Of course, there are fewer bright objects and faint objects in both of these cases, and yet, as I just told you, with each of these kinds of objects, the things easiest to see, the things most apparently bright, are the intrinsically bright ones, the ones that are few in number and far away. We ask the question, can that not be the case with intelligent civilizations also? There is certainly a range in the brightness of the signals they transmit. If we, as the creatures, the intelligent creatures of the universe, are in any way similar to these natural objects, then the easiest thing to discover is not the nearest, it's the intrinsically brightest, something which will be among the farthest of the objects, say, in our galaxy. But if you study this quantitatively, you find that there is a mathematical law which describes the situation. That is, if the slope of the luminosity law is to the left, if you will, of that minus 5 halves law, then the brightest things in the sky are the farthest. If the function, the luminosity function is to the right, more steep than that minus 5 halves law, then the brightest things in the universe are, after all, the nearest. Notice, that's a very stringent criteria, minus 5 halves. I think, in fact, likely that intelligent civilizations have a luminosity function like that of the normal stars or cosmic radio sources. The result of that is, in a way, disheartening because it says that perhaps we're wasting our time looking at the nearby stars. That's not the place to look, just as it would not have been if we were searching for cosmic radio sources before the advent of radio astronomy. But what should you do if that is the situation? You should look in whatever direction puts the most stars in the beam of your telescope at once. You should look in the galactic plane, or, as we have done at Arecibo, looked at nearby galaxies. Because in that case, you can get a billion stars in the beam at once, and test a billion objects for radio emission. Of course, you are looking for extremely powerful signals. What you are hoping is that amongst the 100 billion stars of the galaxy, there are perhaps one or two which radiate signals millions or hundreds of millions times stronger than we have been radiating. The program has emphasized this program, the search of the galaxy M33. This is the heat hydrogen velocity contour map of that galaxy. It takes only about 200 beam settings. That's each one of these spots indicates one of those beam settings. To search this galaxy, so it can, in fact, be done in a few hours. And we have done this at the hydrogen line frequency, the OH line frequency, and at 2380 megahertz, because that is our most sensitive frequency where our masers are located. The galaxies looked at in this program are five, M33, which was mapped entirely, as I just showed you, at the three frequencies. The southern part of M31, which we can reach with our telescope. The two dwarf galaxies from the local group, Leo 1 and Leo 2. And finally, as really a long shot, the central giant elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster in SDA 49. The sensitivity of this search are what you see here. The bandwidth, as I said, is 1,000 hertz. The typical integration time is 60 seconds. The number of bands is 1,008, but in fact, we are frequency switching to two adjacent bands, so we, in fact, get information from 2,024 different frequencies at any given time. The minimum detectable flux, the units being used by Barney Oliver and Sam Belkis, this search is 10 to the minus 24 watts per square meter. If you want to know what that means, it requires an EIRP from distance of the nearest of these galaxies of about 10 to the 22 watts. Now the good news is that's 10 to the minus 6 solar luminosity. It's rather impressive. You can detect 10 to the minus 6 of the solar luminosity from a nearby galaxy. The bad news is that this sensitivity, EIRP, is 400 million times greater than the present maximum EIRP of our own planet. And therefore, the only thing we can detect is something that is far beyond us in its technological activity. The data in this search is not yet completely reduced. However, as you could guess, no signals have yet been found. The other program that I want to mention is one carried out by Paul Horowitz from Harvard University. This one now is a response to the belief that at least we have at Arecibo, which is that very narrow band signals are the likely ones to be found. For reasons of signal and noise ratio, the reason I will get to, very narrow band signals are perhaps the most promising. And so what Horowitz has done is to go to the minimum bandwidth, which is allowed by the interstellar multi-class propagation, which as you see is about 15 millihertz, which is another new unit for me today, has used integration times of 65 seconds, and he has searched the 200 nearest stars, which are like the sun, and appear to be alone in space, all within a distance of 25 parsecs of us. By using our computer system in a very special way, he was able to achieve, as you can see, a total number of channels, which is 65,536, which is the same as 256 squared. The minimum flux density is already this value, which we refer to sort of a goal eventually. He is already achieving 4 times 10 to the minus 27 watts per meter squared. This means we can detect a transmitter at a distance of 1 kiloparsec. If the power of the transmitter were only 1 megawatt, that's like Arecibo, the area of the transmitting antenna is 73,000 meters squared, about the same as Arecibo, in 500 seconds. Now this means that from the stars he was looking at, 25 parsecs away, his minimum detectable signal was about 1/1000th of that of the present Arecibo radar system. Now here is the system. This has to be very perfect technically. In fact, it's closely related to VLBI because of the narrow bandwidths involved. In fact, the Ovidian clock is used to run the whole thing. A very important fact is that the shift, there's a changing Doppler for any signal coming from space, which drifts at the rate of 16 hertz per second as a result of the rotation of the Earth and the curvature of the Earth's orbit. This means that if we did not continuously drift the local oscillator, that a signal from space would actually drift 1,000 channels in the course of an observation. And this would, of course, make it very difficult to detect. So in fact, in this experiment, the computer is continuously adjusting the local oscillator. In fact, every 20 milliseconds, it corrects for those changing Doppler parameters. It keeps the system synchronized, if you will, frequency synchronized with signals coming from space. It then writes the data on the magnetic tape, and this is analyzed, an important thing which is not shown here, through an array processor which can do 10 million floating point operations a second. The result is that he can produce a 65,000 point Fourier transform in 15 seconds in less than the observing time. So here are some examples which are rather enlightening. This is a signal displaced 101 hertz from the central frequency. The signal has a basic signal noise ratio of minus 35 dB, 1/1000 of the noise of the system, yet you see the signal very strongly there. But of more interest are what we see when we try to present these data in a way where one can inspect them and try to find signals. That, of course, is another problem to say. How do you look at a million channels? How do you inspect them for signals? In this case, what he has done is to lay the results of the Fourier transform out in a raster scan, 256 by 256. And here is an example of what he sees. This is an actual record. There are 65,000 values here. What the computer has done is to take only those signals which are more than the threshold of 1.5 sigma, and plot them with different symbols, which are changing in increments of 0.25 sigma. In fact, there are 256 rows of 256 points here. You see what happens if you set your threshold at 1.5 sigma. You get just a cacophony of false alarms. Very interesting exercise to those of us who have to teach things about noise statistics and so forth. If you raise the threshold to 3 sigmas, things get a lot better, especially if you took some of the dust off the slide. The number of false alarms drops to something like 50 to 100. Still not good enough when we're dealing with 65,000 points. Here is an example where there has been, this is 3 sigma again for the 0.5 sigma increment, where an artificial signal has been inserted, which is drifting slightly in velocity. I think your eye can pick it out at the right-hand side of the slide. The intensity of the signal, by the way, is 1 part per 1,000 of the system noise. That is, the basic signal noise ratio is 1 part per 1,000, but yet you see that signal, which is over on the right side, very well. And lastly, here is a slide which is typical of the final way these things are analyzed. Here, the threshold is 5 sigma. As you can see, there are almost no false alarms.